Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elder.
And I'm Ken Reardon.
And welcome to the Landon Donovan for President segment of It's All Politics.
A very exciting day.
Tremendous. America discovers world football.
Well, we call it soccer. But the sad news, of course, as you know, is that Joe Barton has apologized to the Algerians.
Yes, but I thought it was timely the way he immediately apologized for having apologized to the wrong team.
Actually, the real news, of course, is President Truman finally firing Douglas MacArthur.
No, I actually think it was more important that President Lincoln fired General McClellan. As old as we are, we actually don't remember either the Civil War or the Korean War, do we?
I don't remember last week's podcast. So that's it. But the first thing I thought of with this drama leading up to the Wednesday sacking of General McChrystal is Truman, MacArthur, and the insubordination and the guidelines of civilian control of the military.
That's right. But let's also put a little distance between the MacArthur-Truman comparison and the current case, because in that case, Douglas MacArthur really was trying to change American foreign policy and take it in a totally different direction, have Chiang Kai-shek invade China from Formosa, himself go across the Yalu River with American forces and South Korean
forces. But he wanted
to start a war with China.
But you know why MacArthur supported Chiang Kai-shek doing that? It's because he had a type A personality.
And
wait, that's a great joke.
That's really not a great joke. But let's just say that in this case, all we really have is the insubordination of a general speaking in extremely, shall we say, ill-advised fashion and letting his staff speak in extremely ill-advised fashion to a journalist from Rolling Stone, which, by the way, a lot of people had forgotten there was a Rolling Stone.
That's right.
But back at one time, that's where Hunter Thompson wrote seminal works on the American presidential election process. And Bill Greider was their political editor for 17 years, famous American journalist, and now suddenly Rolling Stone publishing stuff that changes history.
If General Stanley McChrystal is as smart as everybody says he is, and military men have been saying from the beginning this guy is a brilliant guy, how could somebody be so dumb and throw it all away like that?
I can answer that question, Ken. It's very simple. 4 and 7. The man sleeps 4 hours a night and runs 7 or 8 miles a day. Now, my law is no more miles run than hours slept. That's pretty much been your rule, has it not? No, yours is no more meals eaten than hours slept.
No, mine is no more Garcia Para.
All right. Now, I think we are finally going to get the strategy right in Afghanistan. We're going to sleep 8 hours and only run 4 or 5 miles. And I think General Petraeus, as the man who, how many people have said it, literally wrote the book on counterinsurgency as a strategy, is somebody who has the credibility of authorship. He has the credibility of authority over this policy, even more than McChrystal did. And he has the backing of clearly both parties in the United States Congress. The Senate is going to confirm him in 15 minutes. And he can, if anyone can, make a respectable showing with this policy in Afghanistan over the next year or two.
Well, see, here's the part that troubles me about this whole analysis here. And this, first of all, one, Petraeus backed McChrystal to the hilt. He and Secretary Gates were his biggest boosters. Two, President Obama said over and over again that there was no policy change. The policy is not working.
No, the policy, the real
not,
problem,
Petraeus
the
is not coming
problem.
In to change the policy.
That's right. The underlying problem here is not that McChrystal is insubordinate or that he's a poor handler of his staff.
Well, he is, and that's why he had to go, but that's not the big issue.
But the real problem is that the underlying sense of what's happening in Afghanistan is not success.
Right.
They haven't really felt that they've been successful in what they've tried to do up to now.
And Karzai is so unreliable.
And it's been said from the beginning, you've got to have a reliable partner in order to make this whole strategy work. And clearly, Karzai becomes less so with every passing month. At this point, I think it's not hard to imagine that if we were to pull out in 2011 as scheduled, or 2012 even, basically he'd turn the country over to the Taliban and strike some kind of a deal with them. That looks like where he's headed.
Which just sounds like what he's doing now. And interesting that one of the biggest boosters of McChrystal was President Karzai.
Now he's gone, so we're going to have perhaps a somewhat more antagonistic relationship between the American leader and Karzai. But that doesn't seem to be necessarily a bad thing from an American perspective. And I'm going to throw out the radical concept that maybe what this does is either, as some have said, buy a little bit of time for Obama for this policy to work over a slightly longer period of time than he gave himself, or possibly turn enough people against the Karzai regime that we make the decision that needs to be made at some point or another from a lot of people's perspective, which is turn mother's picture to the wall, realize that this is not 2001, and pull out.
But that pullout decision is being made as 30,000 more troops are on their way to Afghanistan and President Obama asking allies for more and more contributions.
Which they are, of course, not going to make. That's just simply not going to happen. So between the fact that the allies are bailing on us, that we have no one to ally with in the country, and the fact that the American people increasingly reject the whole rationale and justification for continuing this mission, I think this is a war that's going to wind down and be ended by us.
One of the big criticisms, of course, of President Obama has been that he just is unable to make a decision. He waited a long, long time to step forward in the health care bill. His role in the BP disaster is obviously not
too
going
passive,
well.
Too long.
And yet here is an example of him showing very immediate leadership. Apparently when he read about the article Monday, he decided perhaps Tuesday night that McChrystal was gone, and McChrystal indeed was gone by Wednesday afternoon.
And he seemed to have more support in a bipartisan sense on this. He immediately was backed by McCain and Lindsey Graham and even the third party in the Senate, Joe Lieberman, and lots of people just came out and said this was the thing the president ought to do. Of course, there were others who said, no, McChrystal shouldn't have been fired over this, and it really isn't a firing offense. But the mainstream of opinion, at least within the authority structure, both the Republican side of it, the more conservative side of it, and the Democratic, more liberal side of it, was the president did what he needed to do.
Well, I think that aura of the president getting high marks for a quick, forceful decision may not last long if we, again, sit back and say, okay, now what's this policy that we're defending? What policy isn't changing, and where do we go from there?
Because if
ultimately all we're doing is changing McChrystal for Petraeus, then I don't know what changes ultimately.
Probably not Afghanistan. What's changing in the Gulf of Mexico? Is that situation in some sense getting under greater control? The cap got knocked off this week, but then the cap got replaced. Do we have a little more confidence in the combination of what BP is doing and the combination with the government's efforts? Do we have a little more confidence that this is in some sense or another under better control?
I don't think we do. I think even though Obama's numbers have not changed much, I think there's still a general feeling that the Democrats and the president have not done the job that everybody wants them to do, although nobody knows how to do it. But
whatever that was, it wasn't perfect.
Exactly. But I think, as we've seen many times this year, the Republicans have given them cover by the blunder. I assume it's a blunder, although he may not say it's a blunder, by Joe Barton, the famous apology of last week to the BP Tony Hayward.
This is an interesting question. I mean, Joe Barton was roundly criticized by Republicans as well as Democrats, and then he skinned back his apology
under pressure by the Republicans.
From his own party. But this week, much less noticed than the original incident, the Republicans quietly decided not to take away his ranking member status on that committee, which means if the Republicans take control of Congress this November, Joe Barton will be the chairman of the Energy Committee,
which is
Mr. BP.
Which is the subject of a DNC commercial.
But if Republicans were in charge, this is the guy who'd be overseeing BP.
I apologize.
He apologized to BP and called the recovery fund a tragedy.
So I apologize.
And yet the Republicans did not remove him from that position. Why?
Well, why is because that was a deal from the beginning. They said, if you don't apologize, you're no longer the ranking Republican on energy and commerce. He said, okay, I'm apologizing. But at the same time, he, on his Twitter account this week, he put a link to an article that said Joe Barton was right. Now, if that's not retracting the apology to the apology, then I don't know what is.
What do you think he thinks?
Well,
he thinks he was right.
Anyway, yes, and mysteriously, that Joe Barton was right link disappeared from Joe Barton's website, probably also under pressure from the Republicans.
I think Joe Barton actually spoke his mind the first time we heard from him on this. He thinks it was a shakedown of BP. His sympathies are with the oil and gas industry. And, you know, if you just shift the story over slightly to discussing the moratorium on deep water drilling that was overturned by one court,
the
6-month moratorium, that brings a whole lot of other Republicans out of the woodwork saying, no, you know, the oil and gas industry is our friend. The oil and gas industry is something we support, and they support us, including the judge who made the decision, who owned quite a substantial amount of stock in Transocean, one of the companies involved in this blowout, plus lots of other oil and gas stocks as well. So I think that there's a relationship here that's pretty uncomfortable for the Republican Party between them and the oil and gas industry and many elements of the Democratic Party.
Well, you could also make the argument that a moratorium on drilling in places like Louisiana would be really detrimental to the state's economy. And I think Barbie Jindal says that. Haley Barbour says that. Members of Congress say it. But at the same time, there's another report that came out this week that BP is preparing more drilling in Alaska and
inland, onshore,
with very little safeguards in place.
We've seen that they have a kind of pedal to the metal attitude towards how you go after these resources. And that, of course, is what has been incentivized by the market and allowed by the government. The government has not regulated them with an eye towards protecting the environment or the workers. It's been regulating them with an eye towards collecting the revenues that can flow from this oil and, of course, supplying more domestic oil so we're a little less dependent on foreign sources.
So the practical message out of this is still the president and the administration do not get high marks for their handling of it. But the political message, I think, is that the Republicans in Joe Barton may have bailed them out, at least for the temporary political gain, in the fact that there are now commercials blasting the Republicans and Joe Barton for being in the pocket of big oil.
Shifting the onus of the moment one more time, at least temporarily. What's the message, speaking of political messages, and we got quite a few this week, what's the message out of South Carolina?
Well, it could be very good news for the Republican Party, and that seems very strange to say, given what's happened with Governor Mark Sanford for the past year. I mean, that was an embarrassment, a national embarrassment. Two big stories coming out of South Carolina's primary runoff this week. One, you have an Indian American, Nikki Haley, who swamped her Republican opponent in the runoff.
About 2-1 almost.
2-1, exactly. Congressman Gresham Barrett. If she defeats Vincent Shaheen in November, she'll be...
I just can't stand the tension. I can't stand the suspense. Well, What'll happen?
There is a lot of dissatisfaction with the Sanford administration, and Nikki Haley is really as close to Mark Sanford as anybody who ran for governor this year. Of course, she was endorsed by Jenny Sanford. Mark Sanford vouched for her integrity, which, you know, is always a good thing to have.
She's totally in the driver's seat.
I think she is
going to win in November.
Aside from the history of it, that she'll be the first female governor of South Carolina. She would be the nation's second Indian American governor after Bobby Jindal.
Both Republicans in the South, interestingly.
Right, in a state that, of course, has been very male, very white.
In its politics.
But I think more significant is that South Carolina has always been, at least since its inception in 1980, has been the gateway to the Republican presidential nomination.
The primary in South Carolina.
And no coincidence, but Mitt Romney and Sarah Palin made very high-profile endorsements of Nikki Haley, and she may be a big power broker, perhaps, in 2012.
Oddly enough, I think they both endorsed the same winning candidate in the gubernatorial primary in Iowa. Now, is that a coincidence?
Well, you have Iowa, South Carolina. What you don't have is New Hampshire. And what's interesting there is that the frontrunner for the Republican nomination, Kelly Ayotte, the former state attorney general, is not as conservative as some other candidates in the race. So it will be interesting to see how these would-be presidents, the Romneys, the Huckabees, the Palins of the world, decide what to do in New Hampshire. But going back to South Carolina, another milestone for South Carolina Republicans is the fact that Tim Scott has overwhelmingly won the runoff in the open first congressional district, beating Strom Thurmond's son.
And Tim Scott is an African-American.
But if he wins in November, and he should, he's running against a perennial 16-time loser.
That's worse than us.
No, but you know something that's interesting? Who the Democrats nominated in South Carolina between Alvin Green and this guy in the first district. Something's up there. But anyway, but if Tim Scott wins, assuming he will win, he will be the fourth black Republican elected to House in over a century.
One other thing to mention from South Carolina, Bob Inglis, who was originally a member of the class of 1994, came in
once upon a time a firebrand conservative.
Absolutely. But had fallen afoul of the conservative movement in recent months and years, particularly with the Tea Party, was clobbered in the runoff and will not be the Republican nominee for another term.
Now, he is the fifth incumbent to be defeated so far for renomination. We had Arlen Specter and Senator Bob Bennett, and then we had Parker Griffith and Alan Mollahan in the House. But again, for everybody portraying this year as a big anti-incumbent year, five incumbents in 20-some-odd primary, that doesn't seem to be much of an anti-incumbency out there.
No, and it's interesting to note that if you include Arlen Specter as a Republican, as he began this Congress as a Republican, most of those, all but Alan Mollahan, are Republicans. These are people who were not adjudged to be sufficiently conservative by their own Republican base back in their home state. So that's an interesting point, and it also brings us to Utah. You mentioned Bob Bennett, the senator there. He was not advanced to the actual primary by the participants in the convention system
in
the Utah Republican Party. And the candidate that he subsequently backed among the people who were advanced to the ballot was ahead in the polls right up until Election Day, but in the runoff did not win.
Yeah, again, another victory for the Tea Party, it seems like, in Utah. Both candidates, Mike Lee and Tim Bridgewater, were very conservative, perhaps Mike Lee more so. I'm not sure if Bob Bennett's endorsement of Bridgewater
might have hurt him.
Who knows?
But it seems unlikely. It seems illogical.
But something that is very likely is the fact that Mike Lee will be the next senator from Utah. The state has not elected a Democrat to the Senate since 1970, and that was Frank Moss.
I knew that. Yeah. I didn't get a chance to answer.
Okay, who was it?
Frank Moss.
How'd you know that?
Well, I knew that.
Who'd he lose to?
Orrin Hatch?
That's correct. 1976. Very good. You win a T-shirt.
Thank you very much. Can I have that T-shirt now? Because I'm getting kind of chilly.
One P.S. for the primaries. North Carolina Senate runoff. The Democratic Washington establishment choice, Cal Cunningham, got clobbered by Secretary of State Elaine Marshall. She led in the initial primary, didn't get the 40% needed to win the nomination outright. She will run against Richard Burr and probably lose to him in November.
And speaking of women in Democratic politics, we have coming up next week the confirmation hearings for Elena Kagan, President Obama's second nominee to the Supreme Court.
No filibuster on anybody's horizon.
Well, let's wait and see how the hearings go, Ken. I mean, you don't want to prejudge this. Maybe she'll say something in the hearings that creates a problem.
Well, I think one of the reasons Arlen Specter didn't like her for Solicitor General was she was very adept at not saying anything during a confirmation hearing, so I suspect she'll do the same. I don't know what the controversy is. Republicans do feel that she is more policymaker than a judicial.
She's not been a judge.
Well, no, that's true. But she's more interested in politics, more like an Abe Fortas kind of person.
She is clearly interested in politics. Everything we've seen in her emails tells us that.
Senate Judiciary Committee begins on Monday. We think 3 days of hearings.
Probably 3 days with her, and then maybe an extra day of panels talking about her. But of course, you'll be able to hear a lovely summary of each day's proceedings from National Public Radio next week. And one other name returning in the news that we haven't talked about for a long time, Ken. Jack Abramoff.
Jack Abramoff is out of prison. He was sentenced to prison, I guess, in November of 2006, so it's maybe 3.5 years he's been in the clinker. But he's out into a halfway house now. And not only that, I believe he's still rolling in dough.
Jack is going to be doing market strategies at a kosher pizzeria in Baltimore. That's run by a friend of his, so give a friend a job.
And you know what that means.
That means that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
We like pizza in the morning. We like pizza every day. We like pizza in the evening. We like pizza anyway.
I like pizza, pepperoni, mozzarella. I like pizza with salami, eggs and cheese and